Thanks for the invitation to come, and thanks for the chance to speak here in a center that has such a distinguished tradition. I should warn you, I was downing coffee quite a lot this morning because I had my first high table last night. And I think Americans are naive about many things, and one of them is port. Lauren's to blame for that, but I think it's all in order now. So as Lauren said, I'm going to be speaking about, it is a bit of a curious title, when did trade ever come out of trade agreements, and what does it mean to put trade back in? It's going to take a little while to get in there, so I'm planning to speak for about 30 minutes or so, and then be happy to leave a lot of time for questions. But the basic area that I'm working in, you might say, is the question of fairness in international economic law. But I want to come at the question of fairness in a somewhat different way. The typical approach, you might call the external approach, is you look at principles from political philosophy, principles of fairness. And then you try to transpose them into economic law and say, how does the trade system stack up from a cosmopolitan point of view or from a Rawlsian point of view, for example? And then Lauren and I were just talking a little earlier, human rights, for example, is that an external critique of the international economic law system, or is it somehow internal? What's the relationship between these bodies of law? You talk to many trade lawyers or economists, human rights for them is definitely an external perspective coming in onto the global economy. You talk to others and it's not, or it shouldn't be. But what I want to do today is work on another sort of less well-developed element of this analysis, which I would call an internal approach or internal approaches to the question of fairness in economic law. And this, you'll see I'm going to refer to a couple of examples of internal approaches so you get a flavor for what this kind of approach does. But then I'm going to concentrate on an approach around the notion of consent. And by consent, I don't mean an abstract principle, say, of political philosophy or a political value. I'm talking about what is the role of consent in trade as an experience, trade as an economic transaction. And the thinking there is we start with looking at what is trade as a human experience. I'm going to build out from there a notion of what kinds of regulation are appropriate if they're going to be regulating or promoting trade and not something else. And that's the part that comes back to the title, what is that something else? And I'm going to argue that, depending on your analysis, it might be something like coercion, exploitation, extraction or predation, but not trade. So in fact, what I'm going to suggest in the talk is that we see what are ostensibly trade agreements, but you might really actually call them more accurately exploitation agreements or coercion agreements or treaties of adhesion. And that something has gone wrong with the very fundamental notion of what is the underlying object of an economic relationship. And that's what I'm going to argue is consensual exchanges and promoting consensual exchanges. So that's where we're going to go in a nutshell. And then it's going to take a little bit to get there. All right. In terms of references, I just mentioned up front, I'm working from, there are two places you might want to look at for further information about this. One of them was graciously put on your chair by Kamala, wonderful Cambridge editor, which is a book that's come out, a co-edited book on global justice and international economic law. And I would commend you to a particular chapter in that by Aaron James. I'm going to refer to that. He is looking at a very interesting internal approach to the question of justice and economic law, which I'm going to be referring to a bit. And then there's another source I'd refer you to, which is a chapter from an Elgar book that's coming out, a research handbook on economic law, in which a colleague of mine and I go through different theories of justice and how they relate to economic law. So some of that is also going to be coming out. All right. So, a word first about external approaches. So the basic idea of an external approach to the question of fairness in economic law is you develop a theory, say a political theory, of what fairness is. And then you do the work of transposing that into an economic law context. And we're quite familiar with what that looks like in a domestic context, where you do sort of a normative analysis of, say, a tax structure, for example, or healthcare as a system. And we're quite familiar and comfortable with the practices involved in making that kind of analysis. When you bring that into an international setting, it gets a bit more complicated, and that's one of the reasons why we're looking at some alternative internal approaches. Because first of all, you have to recognize that you're taking principles that have been primarily developed in a domestic setting, and you're transposing them into a transnational setting. So it takes a certain amount of mediation or analysis or justification to see how does this, what's ostensibly a domestic principle of justice, how does it work in a transnational setting? In particular, you run into the question of a sort of a skepticism that's still quite common, that one can talk about norms in a transnational setting. You know, is it possible to talk about global principles of justice? And that's a much larger topic than we can get into today. But it's in the background because it's one of the things that motivates alternative approaches. If you want to talk about fairness in the global economy, it can be difficult to get off the starting point because you get embroiled in these philosophical discussions about what might a transnational norm of justice look like. You know, cosmopolitans have their view on that. Human rights academics have their view. Political scientists have their view. So for those reasons, and also I have to say without firing a side shot at economists, for a long time in the economic law area, economics itself was presumed to be the way to critique international economic relations, international economic agreements. But it was not really fully disclosed that that's just one of a number of external approaches. It's not organic necessarily to trade law or to trade relations. But the way that the field developed, it was quite often assumed that if you have a normative question in trade law, you answer it through economic analysis. So for all these reasons, there are some particular challenges that come from a traditional external approach to the question of fairness in economic law. So what are the alternatives? That's where we want to look at what we're calling internal approaches. What you do there, it depends on the particular theorist that we're talking about, but you can look at a system like the global economy or global economic relations, and that's what Aaron James looks at. Or you can look at an institution like the WTO as sort of a self-contained normative community. Or you can look at something like consent, which is what I'm going to spend most of the time on today, and say what kinds of principles are already inherent in the way that system operates, or what principles flow from the core practices of that system, or what sort of expectations come out of the way the institution is structured that then supply a kind of an internal normative principle or guideline for what justice is in that system or in that institution. Those of you that are interested in jurisprudence would recognize this is something like Law and Fuller's approach to the morality of law. We're recasting the conversation through what kinds of principles come out of the system rather than are imposed onto the system. So for example, Aaron James, in his chapter in that book that I referenced you to, he has an approach he calls structural equity. And what it says there is that at the core of the global economy as a system is a shared practice of mutual reliance on a market. Now, at its core, the global economy looks the way it does and functions the way it does because the participant states share this core practice. They're each relying on a common market, let's say. So out of that, he goes through a series of deductions to say what kinds of basic equitable principles come out of the shared practice of reliance. And I won't take you through the analysis today, but I do suggest you read the chapter. It's a very, very interesting approach. And he ends up with different kinds of principles of equity that he says flow from that assumption. So that allows you then to talk about questions of fairness or justice within the global economy without necessarily getting embroiled in cosmopolitanism, communitarianism, et cetera, those other debates that we're familiar with. Now, these approaches have the limits as well, which I'll talk about at the end of the talk. A second example would be Kai Carmody's recent book on a theory of WTO law, some of you may be familiar with that, where he looks not at a system such as the global economy, but he talks about the institution of the WTO itself. And he says this is an institution that, because of the way it's structured in its agreements, it creates certain expectations among the members. One of the expectations he focuses on is this question of equal justice or equal sort of equality before the law, that members may be very different in their economic size or their political economic power. But structurally, the system is constituted such that they have an expectation that they will all have equal access to the dispute settlement system. Their claims will be adjudicated equally, and there'll be some sort of basic equality in the eyes of the law. So he suggests that, as you might say, a norm of justice within the institution. And then that allows him to look at, for example, the outcome of the dispute settlement process. And one of the examples is the disparity that comes from the effectiveness of sanctions and remedies when you have a developed country that wins versus the ineffectiveness of those kinds of sanctions if you have a developing country that wins. Think about the problems that a small Caribbean state would have in enforcing that gambling decision, for example. So he says that's a defect. There's a defect in the way that the remedy structure works. And yes, it's a structural problem, it's a functional problem, but from his point of view, it's also a justice problem. It's an unfairness because the norm of justice as equality is being violated by the way the dispute settlement system works or doesn't work. Now, he identifies equality as a norm in the WTO, but we don't want to think that equality is necessarily a norm of every international institution. There are some that are constituted quite differently, so you would think about the justice that's internal to those organizations as distinct. For example, the IMF, where the IMF is structured in an unequal manner so that votes are allocated according to contributions, and there's a presumption structurally that there will be unequal voice in the management of the institution. From an external perspective, that may be unjust. You may have a lot of theories about why that's unfair, but not necessarily from an internal perspective. In this case, if the institution is structured that way, then members could not legitimately claim an expectation that it would be otherwise, at least not from within internal principles of the organization. But in another aspect of the IMF, inequality is very central to the justice of the organization. For example, access to resources. The lending practices of the IMF, you might say, are progressive in that those who are in greater need have greater access to the resources, and those with the fewer resources have to pay less and less for them. So in that sense, inequality is functions as a norm of the internal justice of the IMF, but in that instance, we might say it's justifiable by external theories as well. It's progressive. It's those who have less have to pay less. So that in a sense, is one of those sort of core Aristotelian problems you get into in this area, which is in what circumstances should one be treated equally, and in what circumstances should they be treated unequally as a matter of justice? And those kinds of questions come up a lot in international institutions. But I should move on to the main topic I want to talk about, which is this consent approach, which is really a third alternative or a third internal approach to questions of fairness, which is not focusing on an institution, it's not focusing on a system, but it's focusing on something else, which I, for want of a better phrase, I would call a trade as a human experience. What is it that we do when we engage in trade? And the idea here is that if we're concerned about economic regulation, we want to know, what is the object of the regulation? What is the regulation trying to protect? What is the regulation trying to enhance? So just as a basic regulatory question, you need to understand what it is, the behavior, the phenomena that you're seeking to regulate. So you know when you're protecting the right things, when you're preventing the right things. So that's where we start with what exactly is trade as a human experience. Now, and it's part of a larger project in which I try to build this out, but I'll just summarize for us today so we get to the discussion part. So what I start with is a basic idea that trade involves transactions with a small t, that we're exchanging things when we trade. I'm talking here now on an individual basis, not on a sort of a global economic basis, but there are parallels to both. So trade involves transactions. Then you further explore what kinds of transactions, how is trade different from a gift, for example, a trade different from a gift, and then you get into the notion that there is a bilateral exchange of value. You're exchanging objects, services, goods that have some perceived economic value to both parties. So trade is a bilateral exchange of economic value. Then you look again at the question of theft and say, well, what does that tell us about what trade is? We all distinguish at the level of language and response to trades versus thefts. And that introduces this notion of voluntariness into the equation. We might say a theft is an involuntary transaction, whereas a trade is a voluntary transaction. Now, you might be tempted to say the key difference between a theft and a trade has to do with the bilateral nature. You know, a theft is a unilateral exchange, it's not a bilateral exchange. But I don't think that's really at the heart of it, because you can imagine, as a thought experiment, if the thief handed you a cheap watch in exchange for your wallet or your purse, that doesn't make it not a theft. You know, it's now a bilateral exchange of value. The value may not be equal, but what's key is still the lack of voluntariness. So you can see what we're building is a kind of an understanding of trade that it consists of voluntary bilateral exchanges of value. And then I would also introduce as a final element the notion of bargaining. That even where there is not necessarily an explicit bargaining component to the trade, it's presumed that bargaining is possible. There is a sort of background condition that bargaining would be appropriate, that the parties are free to bargain in terms of to seek a transaction that's mutually satisfactory. So where we arrive at, if you allow me sort of this as a premise, is that we arrive at a definition of trade as consensual bilateral bargain for exchanges. So that's really where then we begin. So if we have this sort of working definition of trade, then you want to look at what is not trade. We've talked a little bit about that. A gift may not necessarily be trade. A theft is not a trade. But then I want to look sort of at a more macro level, what are some of the patterns that also don't meet this definition. And the first one is the notion of predation. If you're talking about trade relationships that don't involve consent, and here I'm using some of the language that Simone Weil has developed around consent. Some of you may know her work. She said you can't find consent when there's no power of refusal. So whatever the transaction looks like on the outside, if one of the parties has no power to say no, then there is no consent to the transaction. Whatever paperwork is signed, whatever formalities are observed. So in a basic sense, when you're talking about an economic exchange where one of the parties doesn't have the power to say no, we're not talking about trade at that point. It might look like trade, it may be called trade, but at an underlying level, it's something else. We'd call it maybe predation or theft or extraction. This, lest you think this is too sort of off its feet philosophical, this is very concrete in the contract law. We look at the whole notion of duress as a defense to a binding contract. That's what the law is really focusing there on, the issue of consent. If one party did not express their free consent to enter into the contract, then a court's not going to find a binding contract. So it's, in that sense, it's both abstract in a sense, but very, very concrete and very real to the law. So short of predation, there are also situations that you might call, or I'm going to call coercion, where there is a kind of consent, but it's not a fully freely given consent, where there's some kind of influence put on one of the parties short of what might reach the level of duress, but nevertheless their assent is not 100% voluntary. And that is also something that you see reflected in contract law. For example, in the notion of contracts of adhesion, where, this example we give in the US, you go to these mega stores and buy your plasma TV, and there are lots of clauses on the back of the agreement, but you really have no opportunity to negotiate those. And yet, on a fundamental level, you have assented to the purchase of this television, you've assented to the terms of the contract. So in those kinds of situations, a court, if you subsequently challenge something, they're not going to throw the contract out under duress, but they're going to look closely at some of the clauses, and it may be that there are certain things you agree to, like arbitration instead of access to the courts, that a court might not enforce. They might say, this particular clause is unconscionable, but overall, there is a basic voluntariness to the transaction. So that's what we're talking about as well. In what sense do we see trade transactions or trade patterns that reflect something like a coercive dynamic going on? And then the third one is comes from the work of Hillel Steiner on exploitation. Some of you may have read his work. He's a British philosopher. He develops a notion of exploitation around the notion the concept of equal value. He says, where you see a transaction and it otherwise appears voluntary, but the two transfers are not of roughly equal value, then that may be evidence of what he calls exploitation. Now, by equal value, he's not going back to some kind of medieval notion of just price or anything like that. What he's talking about is the example he gives is of a kind of auction for services or goods. And he says in this particular bidding process, let's say there's a bid of one offeror and an offeree, and there may be some negotiation going on, and there may be consent to the terms of the offer for what the party's bidding. But his hypothetical is that the party that's successfully bids in the auction is not necessarily the party that might, in theory, have given the highest value for that good. It may well be that for reasons which are worth exploring, parties which would value these goods or services even more highly have been excluded from the negotiation through, for example, some kind of human rights violation or governmental interference. You know, at the individual level, you can hypothesize you have a government agent standing at the door with instructions not to let certain parties into the auction. So that's what he would call exploitation, where the violation is not directly in the negotiation, so it's not like coercion where you're pressuring your negotiating party, but you have seen to it that other parties are not even at the table. And in that sense, you're exploiting that external human rights violation, for example, or interference, to get a value or to get a service or a good at a lower value than you otherwise would. So that's an example of what he calls exploitation. So in the same sense in an economic relationship or transaction or trade agreement, where do we see evidence of that parties have acted such a way that the other potentially more attractive opportunities are not part of the negotiation? So that's the basic framework. And what I'd like to do just in the next 5 minutes or so is just illustrate that through some examples from the CAFTA Treaty, Central American Free Trade Agreement. And those of you that have looked at all at the history of economic integration in the Americas or economic integration between unequal parties and generally can see where this is all going because it's unfortunately very, I think, very characteristic of the negotiation. So if you accept the idea that trade is about consensual exchanges, and the trade law exists to structure consensual exchanges among private parties, and itself therefore should reflect a consensual process of negotiation. In other words, there should, and we'll talk about this a bit more, there's a relationship between setting up rules that facilitate consensual transactions and consensually setting up those rules for private party transactions. In other words, the danger is if you don't have a truly consensual trade negotiation process, then you might very well come up with rules that also violate these principles because they are coercive or exploitative or predatory rules on the private party level. So I'll give some examples of that. But why do we care about that? I want to remind you that on an internal level, we're not caring about it because some external theory of justice tells us that those are wrong. What we're trying to look at is have those patterns or do those patterns in some way damage the very social behavior we're trying to foster. Are they, if we're trying to promote trade because consensual economic exchanges are welfare enhancing and efficient and give great value, then if we're doing something else, if we're doing coercive, predatory, exploitative practices instead, we're damaging the thing we're trying to create. Assets are not going to their highest value. Parties are being discouraged from entering into the market. There are social costs, resentment, social tension that comes from these kinds of exchanges. So we ought to care about that. There are reasons organic to trade law to care about whether or not the system is designed around consensual exchanges and protecting and enhancing consensual exchanges. So looking at CAFTA, I'll just give you a couple of examples. you know, not surprisingly, you look at two different areas. When you want to look at the nature of a trade agreement from this point of view, you look at how is it negotiated and what are the substantive provisions. And there's obviously a relationship between these two. Insofar as there are problems in the negotiation, you would expect to see problems in the substantive agreements. So, two issues in the negotiation with CAFTA. One is this problem of theft or underrepresented groups. It's always a difficult issue to sort out to what extent does or can a government speak for all elements of its society when it's carrying out a negotiation. And even fully developed, well-resourced liberal democracies have this problem. You can't necessarily say that the government is really speaking on behalf of everybody. It's particularly a problem when you're working in under-resourced countries with fragile rule of law and difficult democratic traditions, and these countries are negotiating trade agreements. And that's part of the problem in the CAFTA setting. We happen to be a group of us from Boston College. We're down in Nicaragua around this time, meeting with different parties. And you heard a great deal from a wide range of sectors in society that the Nicaraguan government really represented five families. And the treaty was being negotiated on the part of those five families and for the economic well-being of those five families. So there's at least a colorable issue there of to what extent, if that's the way the rules are being negotiated and those are the parties are being negotiated for, then there's a real risk that the rules they arrive at are going to function as some level of theft or predatory or extractive rules for everybody else. There are going to be wealth transfers, there are going to be burdens imposed, there are going to be opportunities foreclosed, and the parties who are affected by that would not have had any opportunity to have input in the process. So there are lots of external reasons why we might care about that from the democratic theory or other principles. What I'm suggesting is we care about it also internally, because then what's happening is there are whole economic sectors of that society that are going to be behaving economically in something short of free consensual bargains. The terms of their bargains will have been set through a rulemaking process that they have no access to. So there's something fundamentally not lined up there between the idea of trade and the reality of those kinds of transactions. Just touch on the idea of exploitation and the lack of alternatives. You know, from negotiation theory, the concept of BATNA, what's your best agreement to best alternative to a negotiated agreement? Well, if you look at the Central American context, Central America doesn't necessarily have a good BATNA to a negotiation with the United States. The United States is such an overwhelmingly important market to the Central American economies. But what's interesting from this point of view is that state of affairs is not somehow accidental or neutral. In fact, over the history of America's relationship to South America, North America's relationship to South America, the United States, you see a deliberate policy to make sure that other countries were not really deeply involved in the region. So that by the 20th century, early 21st century, the economic relationships between that region and other areas in the world are not as developed. Now, there's been a lot of catching up in the last 5-10 years, but nevertheless, the pattern I'm suggesting fits with Hillel Steiner's theory of exploitation. That, in other words, the United States, having consistently acted to exclude participation by others, now can come in with an overwhelming advantage and leverage in its trade negotiations because there simply aren't the other economic alternatives. Now, China's changing that, EU's changing that. Talk a bit about that at the very end in terms of practical things to do that. So one more example, and then I'll come to the concluding part of the talk, because I promised I'd go half an hour, and I'm already going over. Substantive provisions. There are lots of places you can look in the CAFTA treaty, and if you're ever feeling too happy or cheerful, I'd recommend you do that as an exercise. You'll feel suitably low after you finish. But lots of examples where you see remarkably one-sided provisions. And the suggestion is that they come out of this kind of negotiating process. And the concern, you know, lots of external reasons to be concerned, but you take a look at some of these provisions, and I would suggest that they are putting into practice, they are effecting sort of exploitative or predatory economic patterns onto the people subject to them. I'll give you one example. There's a very disturbing relationship, disturbing to me at least, between economic integration and law reform. which is not unique to the United States dynamic. You see it also in the EU's agreements, that you require specific kinds of changes to the law of the country that you're entering into the integration agreement with. A lot of functional reasons why that makes sense. But the problem is when you have such a context of unequal bargaining as you do in the Western Hemisphere, the temptation or the opportunity for very, very self-serving changes in the law is very significant. And what you see, the example I want to give you, as many countries did, Costa Rica had a system in place for protecting its agents and distributors. Some of you studied agency and distribution law. There are recognized problems where you have principals in wealthy developed countries and their agents or distributors in developing countries. There's a lot of inequality in their bargaining position. There are ways that the agents and the distributors can be exploited. So a lot of countries create a national law to try to remedy that balance. Typical among them have to do with conditions under which you can terminate an agent or a distributor if you're a foreign principal, indemnification that you need to offer. The claim has to be adjudicated in a national court, so there'll be some supervision by a national judge over the terms of the dissolution of the contract. Well, you know, there are a lot of reasons why those are seen to be necessary, but they're onerous for principals to have to deal with. They would like to not have to deal with it. So one of the things that the United States did in this negotiation with Costa Rica was essentially require Costa Rica to dismantle that entire system as a condition of the CAFTA treaty. So when you go through the annexes that are specific to Costa Rica, what you find is not only is there a requirement that the law be repealed, but also a requirement that henceforth all such claims or cases arising out of termination of an agent or distributor must be submitted to international arbitration. So taking this class of claims outside of the national court system and into international arbitration. And then I think most dramatically, retroactively amending all private agency and distribution contracts in Costa Rica to have a mandatory arbitration clause in them. So not only prospectively changing the law, but reaching back and altering the terms of the private negotiated contracts between these parties. So I'd say that clearly illustrates some of these problems that we're talking about. Certainly for the parties whose contracts have been modified in this way, there's no consent to that renegotiation. And I would suggest there's very little opportunity for real consent on the part of Costa Rica. They're not going to jeopardize the free trade benefits they're trying to protect in this larger negotiation for the particular legal issues that they may or may, that they may not otherwise want to change. So in addition to other things, this is another talk, but there's a lot of law reform happening at the end of the gun through these integration agreements, and I think it's a problem that needs to be addressed, but it illustrates some of the dynamics we're talking about. All right. So just to sum up then, what have I done here in a very, very short amount of time? I've suggested that there are then in addition to the traditional external ways that we think about questions of fairness and economic law, that there are these other internal approaches and that they should also be investigated. Not that I think they in any way replace external approaches to questions of fairness, but I think they complement them, and I think they do or they might do some things that external approaches have more difficulty doing. You might not get into sort of battles at the front end about consensus over norms, because it is the norms come out of the structure of the organization itself, or the system, or the nature of the experience that's being regulated. Now, of course, that's one of the limitations. Is of course an internal approach is only as good as the account it gives of those norms. So, you might say that you disagree with Aaron James' characterization of the global economy. Or you think Kai Carmody is wrong to characterize the WTO norm as justice as equality. Or you might have a different view of trade, that it's not about consent. Or you might define trade as something that includes some coercion or exploitation as still trade and not something else. So it's not free from controversy, but it's a different controversy. Another advantage of this approach is that it's very rooted in markets, very rooted in exchanges. You know, Aaron James's view is very rooted in the fact that countries are relying on a market. They're mutually relying on a market. So that it creates certain expectations and norms just out of what it takes to have a market succeed. The same with the consent approach. It's very market-oriented. It's about consensual economic exchanges. The idea is if you protect the environment for consensual exchanges, then parties are less likely to accept bad bargains. And therefore, over time, you might see that the global economic system becomes more fair, but not because you're imposing a sort of human rights standard or distributive justice standard, but you're allowing parties to seek their best bargains and freely to look freely for the best possible value. Excuse me. All right, finally, another limitation which I think really bothers cosmopolitans and human rights people. This kind of approach doesn't necessarily give you a legal basis to bind other parties. That's very illustrated in the bilateral trade negotiation scenario. A consent theory doesn't necessarily give you a way to address a legal claim against the United States for what it's doing in these negotiations, in the same way that maybe a human rights theory might give you some kind of language of claims and actions. So I think that's an issue, but I think what it can do is I think it can alter the incentives for private parties and for states. If you promote transparency, and if you are successful in communicating to people what trade is meant to be and what these agreements are not, I think it gets harder for a country to politically sell something that was a free exploitation agreement. It doesn't have the same ring to it as a free trade agreement. So I think insofar as we can make that more difficult, I think that's a success. I think also there may be ways of internalizing the cost of these kinds of exploitative practices through some kind of social tariff or labeling or the whole fair trade campaign, where you make it clear to the consumers that these products are not coming out of, or are not coming out of a context of consensual bargains, and then let the market do something about that. So that's really where I would conclude. I think the hope is that these kinds of internal approaches can give you a different way, a more market-friendly, less philosophically controversial way to try to get at some of these goals of global justice or economic fairness, but in a way that sort of operates, maybe avoids some of the issues that come from the traditional approaches and maybe has some other opportunities. You've been very attentive. I'll just stop right there. Thank you.